I would like to call the Committee of Health and Human Service Policy to order. I believe there is a quorum present. So we have a quorum present. So may I have a motion to approve the minutes for, what was the date on the minutes? July, January 16th, 2019. Can I get, can someone move the minute?
So move.
So move. So move. So Representative Pinto has moved the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevail. So today we are privileged to have the Department of Health here for an overview. We are a little delayed because we were just waiting for the commissioner to find her way over here from another meeting. And so I would like to take the time to welcome Commissioner Jan Malcolm to the table. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, and thank you so much for the invitation to be before you today to share an overview of the activities of the Minnesota Department of Health and public health in our state and why it matters so very much. So I really appreciate your time today. We often are pressed for time to, you know, kind of talk about one issue at a time, so this is kind of a rare and nice opportunity to talk a little bit about the big picture of public health activities in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the invitation. I believe members have copies of the overheads that I'm going to use, the PowerPoints. I'm not going to go line by line. We tried to put together something that might be a resource for you to use as the session goes along, so I hope you find this this of interest, but again, I'm not going to go through every single point. I'd like to introduce a few people on my executive leadership team. I think you also have a copy of the current organizational chart at the Health Department, and we are just in the business of building the new executive team for the new administration, so you'll note that there are a few vacancies and a few folks who have been serving in acting assistant commissioner roles, and I'm very grateful for their help and their service. All the folks pictured here are with me today and available to answer questions. Maybe you guys could just stand or wave. Our Chief Operating Officer, Margaret Kelly, many of you probably know as the state's budget officer for the last number of years under Governor Dayton. I'm thrilled that Margaret has rejoined the Health Department in this important role. Marie Dotseth is the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Health Systems, which is where our health policy and analysis functions and many of our health regulatory functions reside. Deb Burns, Acting Assistant Commissioner for the Health Improvement Bureau, which is where we interface with local public health and do most of our work around chronic disease management and consumer education. And our legislative team, Legislative Director Melissa Finnegan and Legislative Liaison Lisa Timian. I also want to take this time to thank my colleague Dan Pollack for his service as our Deputy Commissioner these last few years. Dan is leaving us literally tomorrow to go over to DHS in a new role. So the deputy role is one that I will be filling soon. So this is part of our leadership team, and we'll keep you updated as new folks are appointed. So again, I really appreciate this opportunity to talk kind of bigger picture about public health in Minnesota and why it's so very important. I want to start off by just sharing with you some of what's good about health status in Minnesota and is a joint product of an excellent health care delivery system, but also an excellent public health system that we have built up in Minnesota over many decades of intentional policy development and collaboration across health care and public health. So you see here a pretty long list of indicators of population health in which we rank in the top 10, first in a number of issues all the way up to 10th. So it's not so much each individual issue, but the fact that on many metrics of population health, we are at the top of the pack nationally, according to a report that is published every year by the United Health Foundation. I think they've been doing this for about 20 years now. And that's so that's always every year we look with interest to see how our ranking is moving in comparison to other other peer states. The less good news is you see here some of the rankings in which we do not fare so very well according to national averages, and those are certainly point us to areas for work to improve population health in Minnesota. Again, each individual point we could talk at some length about why is that, what data sources are used. There are some methodological things with which we might quibble, but even the methodological issues wouldn't take us from 48 to 5. So we're talking about, you know, kind of magnitude of order where we rank nationally on some of these indicators. This is just a quick picture of how those rankings have changed over time. We've never fallen out of the top 10 as a state, and that's good. We've been for a large number of years either number one or two or three. We dropped to number seven in the state rankings this last year, 2018, which is the lowest we've actually been since these reports started coming out. Now, again, we're still in the top 10. That's good, but we're going in the wrong direction. And we're number one as recently as 2006. And again, I think some of the reasons we bounce around a bit do have to do with some of those methodological ways in which data are pulled, which we might quibble a bit. But it's relevant when we see ourselves falling in respect to comparisons with our neighbors around the country. So that the good and the bad. Now I would call this type of the ugly news of public health. It's not new to this committee, but below our really good-looking averages that keep us in the top 10 on many overall and on many measures, we have known for literally decades that we have some of the worst health disparities in the nation when we look below the averages and look at population health statistics in specific communities in our state compared to whites, Minnesota's populations of color, and American Indians experience shorter lifespans, higher rates of infant mortality, higher incidence of diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, and poorer general health. That's not just in comparison to the enviably high average statistics for the white population. This is lower health statistics for our populations and American Indians than their peer communities in other parts of the country. So our disparity story is something that we have been looking at and working on together for many years, but that work absolutely has to continue. This is a slide that, to me, is one of the most important slides in all of the health policy discussions we have. And that really is, to me, it's very exciting as someone who's worked in health policy for my entire career, our understanding of what actually influences health at the population level among groups of people and communities is so much richer than it was decades ago. And these are data that have held true for 30 and 40 years now as researchers have looked to try to analyze differences in health status between groups of people. What produces those differences? The surprising, perhaps counterintuitive, first takeaway is that clinical care, access to, and the quality of medical care services, doctors, nurses, hospitals, and the rest, is only a fairly small part of the story in terms of what is the actual health status of the population. Sounds really counterintuitive that health care itself is only 10% of the influence on population health statistics, and then you see the other parts of the pie chart. Health behaviors. Now, we've known that for a long time, too, that our health status is powerfully influenced by the choices that we ourselves make, the lifestyle choices that we make. But that, in turn, is not something that just happens in a vacuum. The impact of those health behavior choices certainly is magnified by genetics and biology, but also powerfully shaped by the physical environment and social and economic factors. People don't make choices in a vacuum. They make choices in the context of what opportunities and resources are actually available to them. So this is a really important picture. And again, health researchers have confirmed this distribution for a long time. You see, you know, like moves on the margins of the social and economic factors. You know, some researchers will say that's 35%. Others will say it's 45%. But it moves in that range. And the influence of clinical care moves between 10 and 20%. But no matter how you slice and dice it, The picture here is that it takes more than good clinical care to improve the health of populations, which is not in any way to say that clinical care is not important. Of course it is. It's the classic necessary but not sufficient story when we're talking about how to improve the health of our people. It's literally life determining whether you can get access to good care when you need it. But it also, when you think about it for a little while, makes sense to say even the best medical care in the country or the world isn't sufficient to overcome all of these other influences if all we're doing is trying to treat problems after the fact. This is a really just important kind of framework for us to just understand why it is that we need to have conversations that are about more than just insurance and more than just access to clinical care. But the public health mission is to understand how these other influences play into what kind of results we're getting for the people of Minnesota when we collectively strive to do the things that make it as possible as we can for everyone in our state to achieve the healthiest life that they can. So contrasting...
Commissioner Malcolm.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for a moment. I have a question for you.
Thank you.
And thank you for the breakdown here. But one of the things that I am interested in, and I hope we all are in this committee, is that we really want to create, you know, great outcomes for everyone, right? And so one of the things that I'm hoping to see is maybe a breakdown in ethnicity around the disparities so that we can kind of like see what it is and where we are in the state and how we can work to improve those outcomes. You know, and as you was speaking about some of the driving factors within those disparities with the health behaviors and the socioeconomic factors and clinical care and all the things that you have part of the pie chart up there, you know, as lawmakers, I'm hoping that we can also look at, you know, those opportunities and resources that are or may are not available, but also look at, you know, what type of policies and practices that we need to look at to create some different outcomes that can support the needs of those populations that are right now we're looking at with such high disparities. So if we can, if I can get that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow on that, I had a similar kind of thought. It's so striking, these two slides together, Commissioner, that you were just talking about. And I was wondering, you know, if we're going to really be effective in impacting the disparities, when we look at that second pie chart, it would almost suggest that the way we can impact them is we're always talking about giving better care to everybody, but that maybe the most impact we can have on the disparities is through some of these other avenues. Is that kind of the point here? And do you, you know, is your department kind of advocating that the way to address disparities might be more through, for example, the social and economic factors? I know Chair Moran is really interested in child protection. I mean, you know, talk about social and economic factors. If children are growing up in homes where they're under a great deal of stress, where they're separated from their families, you know, right there we perhaps are causing disparities.
Madam Chair, Chair Liebling, you're absolutely right. I think part of the point of this front end of the presentation is just kind of give you the macro picture of what we know about the role of public health and the kind of the construct in which we think about health issues. And then as we go, we'll drill more specifically into what is MDH doing in these areas and what might be some of the most productive areas for future work. We have been working in the area of trying to work on eliminating health disparities for about 20 years now. And I think our strategies have matured nicely and have become more informed by pictures like this, such that we're no longer only looking at how do we get the populations who are experiencing disparities faster access to medical care. That's important. That's, again, necessary but not sufficient. We're not going to close those disparity gaps unless our strategies are informed by this bigger picture of what are the barriers to optimal health for different populations of folks. So hopefully I will get to some of your questions as we go here.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Liebling.
Okay. Is there any other questions? Okay.
Thanks. And please do stop me if I'm going too quickly here. These front-end slides are really kind of context-setting, and then we'll get a little bit more specifically into the activities of the Minnesota Department of Health. So just to kind of contrast, folks often wonder and often ask us, well, what's the difference between what the Department of Health does and what the Department of Human Service does? And on the DHS side, that agency is a very, very large purchaser of health care and deliverer of health care services, sort of interventions, trying to help people who are in need of certain services and interventions. So the kinds of things that they do as opposed to what we do, for instance, if we're talking about treatment for diseases, DHS will provide and fund medical treatment for a child with an infectious disease, measles, say, and the MDH role, of course, is to encourage immunizations, you know, to work with the healthcare system to make sure that, and with parents and communities to make sure that we are immunizing our population against measles. DHS has a very important role in enrolling people in health insurance to ensure that they can get medical treatment for their chronic diseases. What MDH tries to do is to work with a whole bunch of partners to reduce the prevalence of the chronic diseases to begin with, so prevention versus treatment. In terms of addiction and overdoses, again, DHS's role is to fund treatment services and intervention and ongoing treatment and recovery services, whereas the health department role is really further upstream of that, trying to work to understand the patterns of what's driving these diseases. We've begun to see the, and it's not just Minnesota, but the public health community nationally is noting the kind of the relationship between the trend lines in what we're calling diseases of despair and disconnection, because the trend lines for preventable illnesses and deaths related to alcohol abuse, other drug abuse, and suicide are all on strikingly similar trend lines. So trying to understand what are some of the root causes of those manifestations of despair and disconnection in our communities. So intervention and prevention are kind of the, you know, kind of the two bookends, if you will, of what DHS is working so hard to do and what we at the Department of Health are working to do. These next couple of slides really are about kind of the bigger story of health policy in America. And again, what we're coming to understand is can be instructive about why is it that the U.S. spends so much more on health care than other nations, but yet isn't that seeming to get the same return on our investment, if you will, in terms of the health of our people. There's a lot going on in this chart, but you can see the bright blue line there are expenditures on medical care as a percentage of our economy or our gross domestic product. And you can see the U.S. blue line there, and we've known this for a long time, we're spending not just a little bit more than other countries on medical care on a per-person basis and as a share of our economy, we're spending a lot more than our peer countries and, you might say, also our economic competitors in some cases. The light green line is the share of economy spent on the bigger pieces of that pie chart, what we refer to as the social and economic determinants of health. So prevention and other social services, which kind of comprise that social determinants chart, you can see there we spend less than our peer countries on those social determinants, more on health care, less on the social determinants of health, in pretty much the flip of the countries with whom we are starting to try to compare and understand why do our health systems perform so differently. And it seems to have something interesting to do, not just with the fact that our price structure is quite a bit higher in the United States for health care. We know that. Prices are more expensive. But also just the investment balance of health care versus social determinants is literally the reverse in the United States of what it is in most other countries. So we could have a lot more discussion on why is that important and what might that suggest that we want to think about in Minnesota. This is the same data just shown a slightly different way in this bar chart here, if that's easier to see. This is a Minnesota picture. So in Minnesota, we have, you know, our finance committee, Chair Liebling's committee, is Health and Human Services Finance. The top line there is the United States distribution of health resources split between medical care in the dark blue and prevention or public health in the light green. At the national level, we spend about 5 cents on every dollar on prevention. In Minnesota, it's about the same story. If you just look at the Health and Human Services budget for the state budget. So we're not talking about all payers, all sources here. We're talking about the state budget's allocation of resources across medical care and prevention, and there it's about 98% health care, 2% prevention. Just making the point that I think it's sort of part of how we got to where we are in terms of the challenges to population health in our state and what it might take to bend some of those trends over time, which is kind of where I'll go in just another couple slides. This is another, again, back to the international comparison, just another pretty interesting slide here. There's a lot going on here, too. But this plots average life expectancy versus health expenditures per capita among kind of and this is from a different data source. This is the World Bank. That plots average life expectancy versus, again, per capita health expenditures. And you can see the United States there, very much an outlier in terms of per capita health expenditures, but not anywhere near the top of the pack in terms of average life expectancy. A lot of things go into that. And oftentimes the first thing that comes to mind is population diversity, that we've got a very, very diverse country, diverse populations within our country. But the interesting thing is how these trends diverge over time, you know, and how as medicine has become increasingly specialized and technologically advanced, you know, we've been putting a lot of money in the United States into the technological advancement of medical care, which buys us a great deal of added length of life at advanced ages. So we're able to technologically really move the average life expectancy up when it comes to dealing with very complex illnesses later in life. What we're not doing as good a job at is extending average life expectancy over the entire lifespan, you know, particularly with younger people, which is kind of a stunning thing when you think about it. Where our technology is really paying off is not showing up in improvements to average life expectancy in the younger years. So here again, some pretty shocking statistics, how the U.S. compares to other countries around the globe. I think the only country that spends more on healthcare than we do, I believe this is one of the very wealthy Middle Eastern countries that outspends us, but 45th in life expectancy at birth, 55th in infant mortality, 46th on maternal mortality, as international rankings. Now, this does not mean that we haven't made progress on improving infant mortality. Maternal mortality is quite troubling and interesting because we have actually backslid a little bit in recent years. But we have made progress on a lot of these population indicators. It's just that other countries have made far more progress than we have at far less expenditures. So, again, it kind of gets back to that. Now informed by the deeper understanding of all the different things that influence population health, not just medical care, why we might be seeing this pattern. So bringing it back home to Minnesota a little bit, so what's going on here? So we talk about we're spending a lot of money, but we're not seeing, you know, we're not seeing the gain in terms of health status. Why might that be? Well, just looking at the chronic disease burden in Minnesota, we know through our health statistics that we had 1 million Minnesotans who were met the clinical definition of obesity in 2017, so you know about 20% of our population, with obesity-related medical expenditures of over $3 billion a year, so a very direct economic impact from obesity. 900,000 adults age 60 or older had at least one diagnosed, and underscore diagnosed, chronic disease, representing over $9 billion per year. 600,000 Minnesota smokers still in 2017 with excess medical expenditures of over $3 billion per year. So the story of health spending is a story of chronic disease. And the thing about chronic disease is that it is amenable to prevention, to delay of onset, delay of severity, if we really think about how to intervene in the factors that predispose populations and people to less healthy lifestyle choices to begin with. And we simply can't afford to just treat our way out of these threats to the health of our people. It's going to get more and more expensive. Spending related to chronic conditions will keep on going up. What's already in the pipeline, so to speak, in terms of the health profiles of our kids today is pretty frightening when you think about the trajectory they're on for chronic diseases at an even greater rate than what we see in the adult population today. We believe that chronic conditions, it's projected that that spending will increase by over 200% by 2023, up to $15 billion a year. Dementia-related spending, same story, up to $390 million a year. Hypertension-related spending, up 90% to over $7 billion a year. So these are Minnesota statistics for, again, what's theoretically already in the pipeline, if you will, in terms of the burden of illness in Minnesota. So what is public health trying to do about all this? Besides, we love this, we just adore this picture, this young woman who's going to take on the world through health. So what we do at the State Department of Health, our mission statement is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. It sounds like motherhood and apple pie, and it is in many ways. But it's a very inspiring mission statement to those of us who work in public health, and we are proud of the impact that we make on the health and lives of Minnesotans every day, all over the state. And I really want to underscore the importance of that statement, all Minnesotans. We have come to understand so much more deeply how big a challenge that is, and how committed we are to not just managing the public health functions of the state by the averages, but to always, always look below the averages on everything we do to understand how is the burden of disease, how are the risk factors distributed differently across different populations so that we can focus the prevention efforts where they are the most beneficial and tailor the prevention interventions to the specifics of those communities, be they rural, be they racial and ethnic, be they age-related. To have success in these prevention strategies, it increasingly takes understanding a much more nuanced context of what is really facing that population. We talk a lot about prevention. If there's one thing that I hope you will associate with public health, it's that word prevention, that we're there to try to understand trends, understand what's driving them, and go as far upstream as we can to try to intervene in the trends before they impact the health of people and families and whole communities. And we talk a lot about prevention, but prevention is a pretty robust set of things. Prevention is not just one thing. And we like to talk in terms of the levels of prevention. Primary prevention is preventing disease before it ever starts. For example, keeping kids from starting to smoke is primary prevention, and avoiding the tobacco-related illnesses that otherwise would occur to 30 or 40% of those kids. Secondary prevention is helping those who have risk factors, known risk factors for a disease, but don't yet have the disease. So the example there is screenings and testing to catch disease early when it first manifests, when it's the most treatable. Tertiary prevention is caring for someone who's already got a disease, but to manage that disease, to prevent the further negative impact of that disease on the person or the population's health. So those are, you know, primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention are words that we toss around a lot. But oftentimes when people say prevention, they have one specific thing in mind. They think, oh, you mean getting a screening, you know, or getting a, you know, getting an early test or an early diagnosis, or you mean immunization, or you mean trying to encourage healthier eating, active living. We mean all of that, but kind of breaking it down into how far upstream is it really is part of, I think, where we can get sharper in our strategies. We also talk a lot about particularly at MDH and in our some of the programs that we will talk to you about during the session, we talk about community-based prevention, which really is about, again, not just looking at individual people or individual groups of people, but really at the community level. What are those physical and environmental factors, literally in the built environment, in risk factors in the environment, but also in the social structure of communities that can encourage healthier behaviors that can either protect health or threaten health. So really the population health, community level prevention is really looking at the whole and not just the individual pieces. So those are some of the terms that are meaningful to those of us who are doing this work in public health. So this is just the next few slides.
Commissioner?
Certainly.
I want to kind of maybe just respond to your last statement around community-based prevention, but also the level of prevention. I think these are like really good examples. And so one of the things that I know that we've been doing here in this body is looking at tobacco and the impact tobacco has on the impacts of health, from heart disease to lung disease. And one of the things we decided to do here was to focus on, for example, in the African-American community, because of stress and other trauma and other factors, we have a very high level of folks who smoke, and because, you know, a huge amount of advertisement that took place in our community, that, you know, a cool cigarette was a cool cigarette. It was something that we just did, right? But we know that it has a huge impact on health later on in life. But it also has a really impact on how we're spending our money in a system that is not preventing anything from happening, but we're trying to treat it. Or, you know, there's diseases there, and it's costing millions and millions of dollars on the system. And so I just think that as we think about the policy committee, that we're thinking, you know, and the other data that you showed around the world about how we are spending really more money on the back end, and other countries are focusing up front and have better outcomes and greater savings, that we can look at some of these models. Because one of the things I want us to try to do in this committee is look at best practice, look at evidence, the social part of this, I know that doesn't always resonate with everyone, but we want to look to how we can look at science, evidence, best practice, and then come out with some really good solutions about how we can really have an impact, the greatest impact, and really not over the next 10, 15, 20 years, if we're gone over the last 20 years, where the cost of healthcare continues to rise, but we don't have any better outcomes. And so the hope is that we can look at doing this different, doing it better, right? And so look to some evidence, you know, and if it's not, you know, at some point, I think it was Minnesota who was leading in so many of these different areas about great outcomes, and now we're falling so far behind that maybe we also need to look to other states and see what they're doing too and bring some of those practices here. Within the Department of Health, is that something that you have been doing or would like to do or have tried to do within the state of Minnesota?
Yes, Madam Chair, and we'll talk in a few minutes about the work going on in the statewide health improvement partnership that is all over the state now in every county that's trying to do exactly this. And again, I just want to reinforce the point, and you made the point, that we absolutely want to stay focused on encouraging Minnesotans to make healthy choices and to have the responsibility to make the healthy choices. But we also know that what exists in our communities or what doesn't exist in our communities either makes those healthier choices a lot easier or a lot harder. So when we talk about, you know, engaging community collaborations to work on kind of the conditions in the community that create access to healthy foods or create better options for physical activity, the whole kind of movement around understanding, you know, the impact on health of decisions that are made around transportation policy or community planning designs just kind of trying to create the conditions in which people have healthy choices is part of what we mean by community prevention. That it isn't to take away the focus on individuals or the importance of individual choices, but it is to build a supportive environment in which health protective factors are more present than health risk factors. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we mean by community-based prevention. And the evidence is emerging on the importance, and we've known that. Your example about tobacco policy, we've known for a long time that things like tobacco taxes and raising the legal age for purchase, kind of denormalizing tobacco use, we know that stuff works. We know it to, in a quantified way, not only what it does to rates of smoking, but what it eventually does to rates of lung cancer and death. We see those data all around the country. So I think your emphasis and your request of us to be bringing you the evidence to go with the strategies is very welcome.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions? All right, let's continue.
Okay, so this is just to kind of give you a quick glimpse at some of what we do inside the Minnesota Department of Health, kind of under that broad umbrella of protecting, maintaining, and improving health. One of the things we're best known for nationally is our excellence in infectious disease prevention and control. We are really, really good at finding and stopping infectious disease when it happens. It's a result of our very strong epidemiology core, also the excellence of our state laboratory that helps us find things quickly and identify them precisely, and work with our local partners all over the state and with the healthcare system to contain disease outbreaks when they happen. Ensuring safe drinking water through our environmental health part of the department is a very core public health function. Another thing we do through the state public health laboratory is to identify congenital conditions in newborns and to help parents know that and connect them to sometimes life-saving treatments very early in life that makes a profound difference in the life of a child born with a congenital condition. Just an example of this, you may recall that in 2017, Minnesota had the largest measles outbreak in the country that was kind of originated in the Somali community in Minnesota, which had a particularly low vaccination rate due to a lot of disinformation that was happening in the community. And so the fact that we were able to work so well with healthcare partners and with the Somali community, not only to contain the outbreak, but to begin to educate on and to speak to the concerns and the questions and the fears that that folks were having about immunization, is a kind of an ongoing success story from that really significant outbreak from a national perspective. What we also do, again, kind of outside the realm of infectious disease detection and containment, we've just been talking about this the last few minutes, kind of what we do to work with communities to try to make it easier for our citizens to be active, to eat healthy, to quit tobacco. Also in the realm of environmental health protection, ensuring the safety of food in the restaurants, safety of pools and lodging facilities in terms of their basic operations, their food operations, and their water safety, and protecting vulnerable adults from maltreatment in our health regulatory function. So this is just a really quick tour of some of the high-level functions that we do, and I'm going to take you down into a little bit more detail in just a minute. But public health, one of the examples, recent examples, is the Youth Tobacco Survey just last year showed an alarming uptick in the use of e-cigarettes by our kids in schools, just a really significant uptick there. So the importance of working with schools and with parents just to make sure that they're aware of this threat and that the fact that there are dangerous chemicals in those e-cigarettes. It's not just harmless vapor. There's nicotine in the vapor, which we know is dangerous for the developing brain in particular. Some additional types of activities. We oversee the significant investment that the legislature has made over the last number of years in family home visiting. And the real, it's a great example of an upstream strategy that helps young families and parents connect their children to healthy resources early in life, and improves family cohesion, improves not only child health outcomes but child educational outcomes as well. Also, in our health policy function, in our health regulatory function, we're always studying the healthcare system itself, looking at what are the trends in health spending, what are the trends in the performance of the healthcare system, and where might there be opportunities for policy solutions and dialogue about new ways to come at some of the long-term challenges of controlling healthcare costs. Addressing health disparities across populations, again, reinforcing that no longer do we just look at things by the averages. We're always looking in every program that we do about what's the disproportionate impact of this issue or this set of issues on all kinds of populations. Again, cut by geography, you know, what's going on in rural populations, for example, with rates of suicide is something distinctive, and we need to understand that. And looking at the challenges both in health risk factors and differential healthcare treatment outcomes in populations of color. So that is active analytic work that we're always doing. And again, the work around health equity, in 2014, the department wrote what I think was quite a, it was before I came back to the department, really a nation-leading report on health equity and health inequity and what produces it. And the, really the fundamental conclusion was that the root cause of a lot of our inequities that we see not only showing up in health statistics but other forms of inequity as well is that opportunity is not equally distributed across all of our communities. People don't have the same opportunities for health in all parts of our state, in all communities. So that's, again, part of what takes us into that that commitment to work on the entire social determinants landscape and picture, and to look at community conditions as far upstream as we can. Geographically, we have offices all around, distributed around the state. These are regional offices that serve as both kind of outposts, if you will, of State Department health resources to work in partnership with our local public health partners and communities around the state. So I just wanted to let you know here that we have health department staff all throughout the state, close to your constituents. And we really do the work of public health in Minnesota through a really robust partnership between the state health department and local community health boards, 51 of them all around the state. All of your districts are represented by a community health board that has statutory responsibilities for core public health functions, working closely with us. And I know this is not the Finance Committee, and we'll do the budget presentation tomorrow in Chair Liebling's committee, but it's important for you to know that of the entire MDH budget, over half of it goes out of the department in grants to the local public health system and to rural health care providers and health disparities grantees and just a whole bunch of partners all across the state. So we are working hand in glove with local public health and community partners in every community of our state. We also have a very close working relationship with federal agencies when it comes to public health protection. Over half of the MDH budget comes from the federal government, through most of it through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But we have very important relationships with the Department of Agriculture, the Environmental Protection Agency, and Homeland Security for emergency preparedness and response. So those are really our key federal partners. So the public health system really is this rich kind of interplay between federal, state, and local, governmental and public and private, health care and nonprofit and public health actors that make up this pretty interwoven system that we have. And really the quandary of it all is that public health is and prevention is often invisible. In fact, when you think about it, the better we are at what we do, the more invisible we are. The more we succeed in preventing things before they hit your radar screen, the less attention the prevention function gets. And that's just, that's always been true for as long as I've been working in this field. And it's just, it's a real challenge. I think it's a challenge for you as policymakers and for us as public health professionals to really continue to make the case for why we need to pay attention to prevention and why we need to invest in prevention when nobody sees it unless it doesn't work. And I'll never forget in one of the when I was commissioner in my first term, 20 years ago now, the guy who at the time directed the state laboratory came to me all excited because we had a new piece of technology that was going to allow us to detect food outbreaks a lot faster and with a lot fewer cases. And it was just the classic public health story. That's great. We're gonna find and control a whole lot of diseases before they ever hit the radar screen. We used to need 500 or 1,000 cases before we knew, oh, it's the same subtype of an agent, and this is what it is, and this is where it came from. We're now able to do that with a handful of cases in 2 days, so that you never see it. But that doesn't happen without a lot of intentionality and without a lot of investment on the state's part to keep those systems of monitoring for threats and being able to intervene quickly before things become a threat. So that's, in a nutshell, is sort of the quandary of public health. It's always hard to convince somebody that the reason something didn't happen was because of the prevention work that you did to keep it from happening. And we understand that is part of the challenge that you face as policymakers. The challenge you pose to us is to make that evidence case of what's the link between this prevention strategy and that outcome. So it has just been a vexing thing for our field for a long time, is how you prove a negative, how you prove that why something didn't happen. But we sure can tell why something does happen when we didn't do anything to intervene. So I'm just going to give you just a little bit more granular detail on some of the major kind of categories of work at the department. And you can, this doesn't conform precisely to the org chart that you have in front of you, but as a point of reference, and again, you can come back to this at your leisure, but this just gives you, some more statistics on the number of people that we serve in some of our bigger programs. So the Federal Women, Infants, and Children Program, WIC, is a very, very large public health program in Minnesota serving pregnant women, infants, and young children. Over 180,000 people are beneficiaries of the WIC program in Minnesota. We all hope that the federal shutdown is over long before this program is impacted, but we're looking at March and April as the times when this program will begin to be impacted by the federal shutdown. I won't, again, read through every bullet point on here, but you can just sort of see the range. And this is in the child and family health kind of prevention set of strategies, helping young families, providing food and nutrition support, peer counseling, home visiting, special needs services to kids, teen pregnancy prevention efforts, and kind of bookending the food story here, the Women, Infants, and Children's Program. We also, as part of the SNAP program, commodity foods are provided under MDH grants to about 15,000 low-income seniors every month. That program also is could begin to be impacted as early as next month by the federal shutdown. Health promotion and chronic disease is another significant part of the health department, and this is where we do a lot of the working with health care providers on what are best practices for prevention and management of chronic diseases, making sure that we're doing outreach particularly into underserved communities and populations of color who get screened less often for certain types of conditions and cancers. We maintain registries of cancers, for instance, or traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury, so that we can sort of see what's happening to prevalence rates with those conditions in our state. And then, again, not only the management of chronic conditions once they exist, but trying to work to prevent
prevent them. Another program that you hear about periodically from us is the poison control system that is funded through MDH, which handled in 2017, as you see here, over almost 47,000 calls from patients who were concerned about, either had been or were concerned that they had been exposed to poisonous or harmful substances. So we're preventing lots of emergency department visits and encouraging a lot of necessary emergency department visits through that important function. A community health, this is the part of the department that really manages that all-important relationship between the state public health agency and the local public health agencies in your districts, helping, you know, not only distributing the grant funds that come from the legislature and from the federal government through us in a way that is intended to coordinate and, to the chair's point, really work on best practices of what we know is most successful in terms of local public health activities. I mentioned before, the last bullet point on this slide, the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership, CHIP for short, that was started in 2008 as part of the big Minnesota reform initiative back then. It's been running now for a decade. Funding's been up and down, but current funding level is a little over $17 million per year in funding and support, which is now in every county of the state and 10 tribal nations, that really creates this community basis for prevention that we talked about before. Coalitions of folks working not only in government but across stakeholders in the community to look at what are the things we can do in our community to support healthy eating and active living, to decrease commercial tobacco use and exposure to secondhand smoke. And one of the things that I have loved learning this last year being back at MDH is, while this program was started to work on the risk factors that we know drive the majority of chronic disease, which are healthy eating, active living, and avoidance of commercial tobacco, those are still the big three risk factors that account for about 60% or more of the chronic disease burden. In addition to those really kind of high-value risk factor reduction programs, what communities are doing with these community collaborations that have now been built is to say, hey, we've got this great cross-sector ability now to talk about all kinds of issues that are of concern to us. These coalitions can come together to talk about what's happening with opioids in our community. What should we do about the specific, you know, kind of suicide trends that we see in our region? Communities are starting to use this collaboration infrastructure for a whole lot of local community priorities that are important to them, as well as these kind of statewide big risk factor strategies that we've talked about. And I think this is just an essential piece of prevention infrastructure across our state that's been built up over the last decade thanks to the legislature's support. In health policy, I mentioned before, we do just a lot of things to study the health system itself. We work with the University of Minnesota to publish surveys every couple of years about insurance coverage, who's and changes in the patterns of who's covered and who's not, and covered by what, and what's happening with costs, and how is the share of who's paying what part of the cost across different markets. We just got a ton of data that's very useful for informing the policy discussion about how the health insurance landscape and the health care landscape is changing in Minnesota. Also in the health policy arena is where the Office of Vital Records resides, which maintains birth and death certificates for folks all across our state. Another health reform strategy back to 2008 was to work with clinics to really encourage the development of what are called healthcare homes, you know, models that really intensively coordinate the care and really build more resources around primary care as the kind of the front door to healthcare for people. And that program has been very successful. We've now got almost 400 clinics that have certified healthcare homes as a part of their practices, and that an independent analysis has shown that care coordination model has saved more than $1 billion in public funds, Medicaid and Medicare spending over the last 5 years. Again, I mentioned, you know, that over half of the funds that are allocated to the health department go out in the form of grants to local public health, but also you see in the last bullet point, over $20 million in grants and loan forgiveness awards are distributed to really protect the health care delivery capacity, particularly in rural and underserved communities through loan forgiveness and other workforce strategies. So the health policy function is one that, again, I think is a perhaps not the first thing you think about when you think of the Department of Health, but that is, we think, one of the important functions that we play is to study the system itself, to always be looking for what's really happening underneath kind of the surface and what might that suggest as policy options for you, for policymakers. Another function that's a little bit newer to the department's charge as of 2015 is the state's medical cannabis program that we manage, which began in the summer of 2015. As of the middle of last year, we had enrolled over 16,000 patients. That doesn't mean there's 16,000 at any one time, but 16,000 folks have been through that program. And over 1,200 healthcare practitioners. As you may know, the legislature identified the initial number of conditions that would qualify for medical cannabis when certified by a health provider and when prescribed by a pharmacist. The health department and I, as commissioner, am responsible every year to take public petitions on adding conditions to the program and looking at the research to see what is there anything published on the benefit of medical cannabis for certain conditions that have been petitioned by providers or others or consumers. So that is an annual process which commissioner announces the addition of conditions, and you can see over the last few years the commissioner has added post-traumatic stress disorder, obstructive sleep apnea, autism spectrum disorder in 2016 and 2017, and this last December 1st, we also added Alzheimer's disease as a qualifying medical condition, specifically some of the behavioral aspects of that. So that's an interesting program. I think it's quite a rigorous, very medically based program in Minnesota, different than some other states that have kind of looser programs. Ours is quite rigorous in terms of the requirement for medical provider certification and pretty close control over what conditions are added there. So that's just another of our activities I wanted to make you aware of. Environmental health, again, I'm going to wrap up pretty soon here and hope that you have some questions for us. And again, I'm not intending to go through every dot point, but just the size of the environmental health footprint in Minnesota and the degree to which we work with water systems, both public and private, across the state to try to keep the water supply and the food supply safe across our state. Infectious disease, I think we've talked a lot about this, but there's some interesting statistics on this slide you can look at your leisure. Sexually transmitted infections continue to be a major concern. Childhood immunization, outbreak control, tuberculosis continues to be an active disease that needs to be managed. And you see here the second to the last bullet point, incidence of particular infectious diseases and the increase thereof that is associated with injection opioid use. And we've also over the years just gotten better and better, I think, at working with our healthcare providers on really close coordination with them on how best to handle things like suspected Ebola cases. Like what do we all need to do together to manage a potential for high consequence infectious disease outbreaks in our state? Yes, Madam Chair.
Have you seen the number of immunized infants, is that rising, or do you still see that there are still individual or parents who believe that, you know, it is not safe to immunize, you know, children, yeah, babies?
The answer is quite different from community to community. Mm-hmm. And and interestingly, it even seems to vary with the type of vaccine. But yes, in general terms, we really are concerned that everybody have, you know, accurate information. There are a lot of concerns, a lot of questions. Folks are fearful about can be fearful about vaccines, especially when they read some of the information that's out there. So, working to make sure people have accurate information and make informed choices in consultation with their healthcare providers is very important to us. And we talk a lot about, you know, there are some folks who shouldn't be vaccinated, which is why we talk in terms of herd immunity being so important. You know, that if most of us are vaccinated, that helps to protect the folks who shouldn't be vaccinated or choose not to get vaccinated to be less at risk for infectious disease because the community around them is largely immunized. So I can give you a more specific answer to that question. We can certainly pull some recent trends for different types of vaccine in different communities, but it's a mixed picture.
And Commissioner Malcolm, I'm also concerned about who shouldn't be vaccinated. I mean, you know, who shouldn't be?
Again, I think that's quite specific to specific vaccines and conditions and people who may be, you know, have known allergies to the components of a vaccine, for example.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so the laboratory, we've talked a little bit about this, but if anyone who'd be interested in taking a tour of the lab, it's a really interesting tour to take, and I think this reflects really a pretty great example of a smart partnership between the state and the federal government. Because of Minnesota's support for public health and for the public health laboratory in particular, we've built one of the finest public health labs in the country, and we are one of the top labs in the country that often serves as a reference lab for other labs, and CDC often has us doing things that are sort of at the cutting edge of laboratory science and public health because of the capacity that we have here. And it's just, and we also get lots of federal investment in the lab now, which also accrues to the benefit of the citizens of Minnesota, because obviously the lab equipment isn't only used for federal grant purposes, but is available to help us with, you know, increasingly sophisticated testing of a whole variety of things in the infectious disease realm and also in the environmental science realm. And that the newborn screening program that I mentioned has really grown amazingly since the program was first developed. We're now screening for 61 rare treatable disorders in that newborn screening program, and some of the stories that come out of that program are pretty wonderful. So the lab is really quite a resource for our state and region. Health regulation, mentioned this earlier. This is the part of the department in which we have some oversight responsibility, either licensure, complaint investigation, federal certification of over 4,000 healthcare facilities, from hospitals to nursing homes to mortuaries to all kinds of different individual provider types, more than 6,700 health professionals. We also have responsibility to monitor certain aspects of health plan insurance functions, specifically provider networks and quality assurance systems. We work with DHS on a number of these programs, particularly in the long-term care arena. So can talk at much more length, and I'm sure we will, in the context of policy proposals that we hope to bring forward to continue to work on improving the regulatory functions in particularly with respect to long-term care and the care of elders and vulnerable adults. And the health operations function, kind of the inner workings of the health department to make the whole thing go, to employ our 1,500 employees, to provide them with the technology supports that they require, the human resources that they require, and to, from a financial perspective, oversee the fiscal management of that significant amount of outgoing grant funding that we are responsible to manage. And that is a very, very quick tour of an agency whose responsibilities I think are surprisingly broad when people find out all the different things that are encompassed under that broad umbrella of protecting and maintaining and improving the health of all Minnesotans. There's a many, many different dimensions to that mission, which, again, I'll just sort of repeat the main thesis. Most of what we do affects most everybody in Minnesota some way or another every day, and 99.9% of the time it's quiet and behind the scenes, and that's the way we like it, except to the extent that it makes it harder for people to quite understand, you know, what it is that we do and why it's important. The better it works, the more invisible it is.
Well, thank you. Do we have any questions? All right, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for the great presentation and for your wonderful work on behalf of our state. I would love to hear a little bit more about immunizations. For a state that takes such pride in its health and health care, our rates are shockingly low. Tdap, it's not just a story about MMR. It's
right.
Tdap and HPV. I'm wondering if you can just flesh that out more for us as to what's going on there.
You know, I wish that I could. I didn't bring our director of infectious disease today, but I don't. I'm just going to turn to my colleagues and see if anybody has any better up-to-date knowledge than I do. Anybody want to get back? No. Nope. We certainly can get back to you, because I had the same when I looked at these slides. It was like, whoa, bud, that's, tell me more. So I think it's a great question. I'd love to get you some follow-up data on that.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Morrison. Yeah. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a small question. There's the I know that there are grants for ending health disparities. I think the Ending Health Disparities Initiative. Is that, which office is that in? I may have just missed it in your presentation.
It's in the Health Improvement Bureau. The Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative is managed by the Center for Health Equity, which is in that bureau that's titled Health Improvement under Deb Burns' leadership.
Okay. Madam Chair, so I guess it looks like that's under the Community Health Division.
Division, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Hey, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of questions, if you could help me with them, Ed. They're going back toward some of the earlier presentations when we were talking about life expectancy and health expenditures, and then take a look at where we are. I'm taking a look at slides 13 and 15. And one of the things that was brought up is you'd mentioned that poor performance, one of the things that had been mentioned, we've got 60% of our population that has got one diagnosed chronic disease, which is a large portion of our population. And what I'm wondering is, when I try to compare back to some of the other countries on chart 13, I'm looking at the countries that might have similar age characteristics of the population to ours, to try to quantify there, because I think there's a difference. Some of those countries have very young age populations. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking like Sweden, Germany, Switzerland, that might be more in that kind of realm. So what I'm kind of wondering, they have an older population too. Do they have that same representation of people with chronic diseases? And if not, what are they doing differently that they don't have some of these same problems that we do?
Commissioner Mapham.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, I think, you know, you're right. I mean, I think a lot of these statistics need to be and are, in some of the more refined analyses, really adjusted for demographic differences, so that, you know, a country that's got a much lower average age, you'd expect to see a different proportion of chronic disease. The countries, though, that are aging at about the same rate that we are, you know, do have different kind of health risk profiles. You know, they have lower obesity rates than we do. They walk more. They, you know, their activity levels are more built into their the population density of their cities, their transportation infrastructures. So a lot of it kind of does come down to some of just the kind of the, again, those kind of community conditions that lend themselves to more or less physical activity.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm understanding you, a lot of it are other things that are not just related to a person's physical health, but the opportunities that the communities are providing themselves. What are some of the things that they're doing that we're not, that we could be doing a better job of here?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Well, I think that the chart that kind of looks at the distribution of spending between healthcare and social services is really pretty instructive, and that tends to show up particularly in statistics like infant mortality and maternal mortality, where you know, some of the other societal investments that are made in housing, for instance, or income security, really show up in some of those infant mortality and maternal mortality statistics. I remember very vividly hearing of a former Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. David Satcher. He was actually here in Minnesota at one point. This was years ago. And he said, you know, when talking about these international health system comparisons, he said, if you want to look at one statistic, look at infant mortality, because it just tells you so much about, how good a job we're doing in targeting medical interventions where they are clearly needed, but also, you know, this broader picture. And he said, what do you think is the number one predictor of infant mortality? And folks would tend to say access to prenatal care. And he said, it's maternal income security. You know, when you think about it, it's like a pregnant woman, does she have a place to live? Does she have, you know, a stable environment? Does she have, you know, what level of stress? So it's just, and that was a good 20 years ago that I heard Surgeon General Satcher say that. And it's just, it's stuck with me as such a great kind of example, because it is counterintuitive to think, well, how can you be saying that, you know, that healthcare isn't enough? But when you sort of start to unpack what does it mean for people to have, you know, to be surrounded by factors that increase risk and increase stress versus not. I mean, obviously, it's a totally different set of policy and sort of cultural choices that countries are making differently, but it shows up in the statistics.
Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wow, that was very enlightening for me. I had not realized that the maternal income and stability was a large predictor there. But as you explained it makes sense. I would imagine they have more child care that's available and those kind of things, so that the women can be very successful at both areas. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit to another part of your area, if that's all right. Yeah. And that would be under environmental health, well testing. One of the things that I was kind of wondering is, I know that it's mentioned that the wells are tested when they first go into the ground, but what I'm wondering is, in terms of private wells, I know we test public wells on a very regular basis, but in terms of private wells, what kind of testing program do we have for private wells after they have gone in, and how regularly is that done?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, it's a great question, and private wells are a real concern, because it's really the burden is on the homeowner to get that testing done. I mean, we try to educate and encourage, and have some grant programs to try to help make that more possible, but it's part of why we need to kind of redouble our efforts on source water protection and really understanding what are the unique water quality challenges in different parts of the state.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Representative Moran. So I'll just have a follow-up on that. So am I correct to assume then that after the private wells are in, that they no longer have to be tested at all, even when they're sold?
Excuse me, just a sec.
Anybody that is correct?
Yep. So even at point of sale, there's not a requirement for testing currently, right? It's very much encouraged, and we try to educate, and local governments try to educate, but there's a lot of responsibility on homeowners who may or may not have any sense of the risk they might be incurring.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was afraid that was going to be the situation there, but thank you for the answers.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner, and I totally believe in prevention and public health and long-term investing because that 10% in health care keeps growing, and it's a challenge to all of us on our state budget. But I was struck by the slide 16 on page 18 about chronic conditions in the next 5 years and the growth in them amongst people age 60-plus, 218% increase in projected spending. Hypertension will increase 90%. Dementia, I'm not so sure. We've got figured out the health prevention and promotion activities that can influence that. But I'm wondering if you might have your staff get back to us on what we're doing with older Minnesotans on the prevention and health promotion side, because I'm seeing communities really back off from that. We as a state and as a society have really valued children, and we should. Our statewide health improvement program really has focused on kids and getting them to not use tobacco, addressing, you know, childhood obesity, because we know it often leads to lifelong obesity. But in terms of the pressures on our budget, we really can't afford to leave this group out. And I'm seeing communities across the state backing away. I'm seeing senior centers that would promote health, social engagement, physical activity, those sorts of things, closing all around the state because of tight local budgets. I mean, even Minneapolis, we had one downtown senior center, and that closed recently. Mm-hmm. So for the whole population of Minneapolis, that one disappeared, even though it was on a bus route to everywhere. And so I'm just wondering if we're doing enough, or what are we doing as kind of an environmental scan on this, you know, 50-plus age group to make sure that they can go into their senior years, you know, more robust, more healthy, and avoid or at least delay some of these chronic conditions.
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, thanks. I think that's very insightful. We do spend a lot of our attention on the youth, which makes sense from a long-term prevention perspective. I don't think we're as holistically focused on healthy aging as we might be, and we've actually been starting some conversations over the last couple of years with the Department of Human Services on how could we do a better job of kind of combining forces and looking at all the different ways that we touch aging as a population health concern and get a little bit more robust a strategy. Certainly we hope that the SHIP activities, even though they may be, you know, they may start out with kind of a youth focus, in mature to become more of a, you know, a community-wide prevention planning focus. But you're absolutely right to say we haven't made a particular point of encouraging the same kind of focus on healthy aging that we have on healthy growing.
Representative Loeffler. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just think that's an area where this is the first time I've seen these numbers about projected growth rates, and that's really key. I see a lot of inflated numbers that assumes whenever the baby boom turns 65 that they instantaneously become totally dependent and ready to go on MA in a nursing home, and we know that's not true in this committee. But we don't do, I think, enough to help people, you know, avoid that for as long as possible, and that our goal should be that people, you know, are healthy throughout their lifespan as long as possible and prevent a lot of this. I mean, hypertension can be regulated, and not just through drugs.
Commissioner Malcolm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the point, and again, I think there's some nascent kind of conversation about how we might organize this and elevate this a little bit more in an interagency partnership with DHS, and I'll certainly bring back your encouragement that we do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask a question about or comment about the wells in a minute, but I think in the conversation of what happens to our 65 and plus, we need to really examine all the different options there are out there. Rural Minnesota uses a lot of aging in place, and friends and neighbors, there's some different things going on there. So unless somebody's extremely isolated, there's a lot of opportunity out there. Sometimes I find it just is difficult for them to try it out at first. And you're probably talking about a much older age than 65. A personal example, my father needed some foot care and kept going to the doctor, and the doctor retired. But now what do I do? And I said, well, public health provides this every other week, Dad. And he went, and now he's probably got a social place he's going to be going shortly. So he's probably listening to me. Oh, no. we should probably review the programs that we have, because there is a lot of different things that suit whomever, and maybe there aren't as many. I noticed that the senior citizens, even in our own communities, are kind of evolving, changing, as you see more people retire. So there's some changes there. But, Madam Chair, I also wanted to make a comment about wells. I live on a personal well, and I have an opportunity to test that if I so choose. And it's pretty simple. I just run some water and bring it into in a glass jar to my soil conservation, and they tell me what's in it if I think there's something wrong. And one thing I think we need to understand is that wells are not forever. Often we have to repair them, check on things. They're pulled up every once in a while to make sure the standpoint is clear and doesn't need to be replaced. So there's a lot of detail that goes into, and when you do those things, maybe it's not mandated by the state, but it is common for that to be done at that point, so that you know what you're dealing with. Your water is being tested. And so just a point of information. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gill. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, thank you. I was going to comment as well that, in general, I think we have a really excellent Department of Health, and one that we as Minnesotans really can be very proud of, notwithstanding, the occasional blip, which everybody is going to see, So we've had some recent issues which you came in to help fix, and we appreciate that. But it's interesting because I sort of was going to almost ask the exact opposite question of Representative Loeffler, because I kind of think that, we spend most of our money on the old, and we spend so little on the young, really. And what we were talking about here with the social determinants and, the trauma that we know now impacts kids and all of that, I would like to see us, of course, funds are always limited, but we know that we live at a time when more of us are older, when the workforce is already very difficult, that we don't have enough workers, that it's going to get worse in the future. I mean, this is what we're seeing from our demographers. So if we're going to have any hope of getting arms around that problem, even if only because of our own self-interest as older people, we're going to have to focus on the young, and we cannot afford to let anybody be less functional than they could be and have poor health or any of those things. I mean, it's just a disaster to us as a society when any child is growing up in conditions where their full potential can't be met. So I think that that's something we have to take really seriously. And I know that Representative Loeffler is absolutely not saying the opposite of that at all, but it's a different... But here's my question for you, so thinking again about the old, is whether the department looks at social isolation as a risk factor. And the reason I think about this is that social isolation among the old, I think we're starting to understand how much impact that has. And then when we think about the young, there is sort of a natural alliance between the old and the very young, right? They have, as people say, grandparents and grandchildren are really close because they have a common enemy, right? But, there is something to that. I mean, throughout a lot of human history, people grew up in more, less isolated families where grandparents were there, and it was, children were cared for by a variety of people. Grandmothers had a larger role, not that I'm talking about myself at all here, but, So I'm just wondering if that's something the department is looking at in any sort of organized way, because it does strike me sometimes that we might be wasting resources by not making better use of our older people to have more impact on our young people.
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair and Chair Liebling, I think you and Representative Loeffler are both right. I mean, we it does make a ton of sense that we focus a lot of our prevention efforts on the young, and from a social determinants perspective, and you're right, the vast majority of health care spending is on the older population. So it's not an either or, it has to be a both and. But I do think, you know, also thinking about the elderly and some of these trends that we're seeing in chronic disease, and we know, and I keep trying to convince my mom this is true, I haven't gotten there yet, but that it really is never too late to try to improve your fitness, that helping older people continue to move and be active and be, you know, socially connected, and to think about those, you know, to think about aging, you know, still fitting a prevention strategy. I mean, I think that's where the, you know, kind of the mindset needs to shift, that it's not an either or, and we shouldn't fail to do all that we can in the prevention arena with a rapidly aging population as well. Social isolation is absolutely a significant significant thing and a significant risk factor, and we think it's very related to this cluster of diseases of despair and disconnection that I talked about. And it's also a really powerful, you know, on the flip side, it's a powerful protective strategy. Social cohesion is a really important thing when it comes to dealing with adverse childhood experiences and trying to help, you know, community strategies to try to deal with some of these trends. And particularly the, you know, as you say, that, you know, encouraging, again, I think this is best done at the community level through, you know, kind of cross-sector partnerships like SHIP, to say, how do we use all the assets in our community? How do we make it most possible for generations to connect and people to gather and to feel part of the community? So it is actually it's a fascinating area of emerging work to understand social resilience and, you know, what isolation or connectedness has to impact on that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need to hit the softball tossed up earlier by Chair Liebling as the chair of the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division, because, yes, I'm cheering all that you had to say, Chair Liebling. And I want to highlight for the commissioner and the members, too, of this committee, that Susan Castellano, who appears on the org chart here, in the maternal child health area on the Child and Family Health Division, she gave a really powerful presentation the other day in our committee about infant mortality and maternal mortality, just recognizing the work being done by the department, and just talking about, and as our committee has been, and several folks on this committee or members of that committee, talking about the importance of investing in at those earliest stages. So I really want to lift that up for everyone. I did have a thought that maybe coming off of Representative Fisher's questions, when I look at chart number 13, slide number 13, the life expectancy health expenditures chart, I've seen this before, showing what an outlier the U.S. is, and that we spend so much more money than other countries with so much lower results in terms of our life expectancy. And I guess I've always thought of this chart as showing that we are spending money the wrong way in our health system, which I think it may well be showing. But looking at it with some of these other charts, just seeing that many other countries, I guess, and I just like a comment from the commissioner on this, the chart on slide 8, I guess, showing all the determinants of health, that actually it's not surprising that expenditures on health would be only a small determination of life expectancy. I guess in a way this chart is kind of misleading, because it's showing life expectancy and health expenditures, but health expenditures would only be a small part of what would impact life expectancy anyway, because mm-hmm. there's all those other factors, and so many other countries invest a lot of money in other areas as well. So I guess if the commissioner could just comment, I think hopefully you understand the point that I'm making. How can we be thinking about what we are achieving when you think about all the funds we could be spending that go into life expectancy? Because it really is not just health expenditures. We also are spending less in human services and other areas. About kind of the bang that we're getting for our broad societal buck here as government is spending money in these different areas and the results in life expectancy. Long question, Madam Chair, but hopefully she can handle it.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, Chair Pinto, I think you're
very right. I mean, it really, a more robust chart or a more complete story would be the sum total of health care and social service expenditures and life expectancy. And we'd be more in the middle of the pack there if you added the social service expenditures. That gap would close a little bit. But I still think when you look at the, you know, our ranking on the individual kind of the statistics below the average life expectancy, which tells you a lot, but it's a pretty rough aggregate measure. It's, you know, things like, you know, how can we be so bad and falling in terms of international comparisons on things like infant mortality and maternal mortality? That's where, you know, that the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of the ratio of overspending, in quotes, on health care and underspending on social services, you know, is really makes the point that we're not getting the bang for the buck. But you're right in the sense that that the chart on life expectancy versus health expenditures would, you know, you'd almost expect to see that. But it does suggest that, you know, the United States' reliance on health care expenditures as the main tool isn't giving us the results that we would hope or expect.
And Madam Chair, I guess to the Commissioner's earlier points in response to Representative Fisher about how the built environment makes such a big difference. How dense are our communities? Are they walkable? What are we spending on environmental factors? We're just looking at this chart, seeing this quite a lot. So even, I guess, arguably, Commissioner, it's not just even social service spending, the other spending that we do as well that has such an impact on health. Would you agree that that needs to be sort of thought of as well as part of this? Are we spending as well as other countries in those areas?
Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, yeah, and that's actually that the pie chart slice that is physical environment does include things like built environment strategies. So that is very clearly a one of those kind of community contexts that sets up a population for different health behaviors over a lifetime.
But thank you. You know, we're over our time, and I'm glad you guys were excited to stay here a little bit longer. But just want to remind us really quick that at the Health and Human Service Policy Committee and Finance Committee will do a joint informational hearing on Friday the 25th at the MILAX Event Center. So, and that's from 1 to 3:30 here. Thank you so much, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the time.